Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Lori Townsend.
Hello, thanks for joining us. My guests today are Kyle Hopkins with the Anchorage Daily News. Hi, Kyle. And Jacqueline Estes is with the news department at KMBA, the native station here in Anchorage. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi.
And also joining us on Skype is Jennifer Canfield. Jennifer is the state government reporter for the Juneau Empire. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for joining us as well. We're discussing rural Alaska today through the lens of the recently concluded Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, and also through the work that Kyle's been doing on a series. So we'll be talking a lot about that. Let's start by reviewing some of the topics that were raised at AFN. There was a lot of attention given to the issue of substance abuse, domestic violence, and sexual assault this year. It's a perennial issue, but it was at a level that in more than a decade of covering AFN, I've not seen before. Jennifer, do you think that's true? You covered the Elders and Youth conference that precedes the main AFN convention. Was it amplified? What did you hear from young people during the Elders and Youth?
It definitely seemed amplified. I mean, I've been going to Elders and Youth conferences since I was a youth, and as a youth, they could sometimes be not so interesting, but this year's conference was nothing short of electric. It was really amazing to see these kids talk about their lives. There was a group from Tanana, the Tanana 4-H kids that got up, and I'm sure everybody's read about them by now, who did something I've never seen before. And I think a lot of the people who I spoke to at the conference said they'd never heard before. These kids got on the stage and talked about their personal experiences with these topics, alcohol abuse in the family, sexual assault, domestic violence. These are kids, some of these kids are still living in these situations. So these weren't kids that were saying, weren't repeating talking points given to them by teachers saying these things are bad. These are kids that were living in these situations and saying, we're tired of this and we don't want to deal with this anymore. And it was, to say it was alarming would be an understatement. It was really incredible.
Jennifer, there was a young woman who had some sort of kind of electrifying things to say about elders and the respect that should or sometimes should not be given to elders. Tell us a little more about her story.
There was one young woman out of the seven students who got up on the stage with the Tanana 4-H. All of the kids that were up there, their stories were compelling, but this one young lady who spoke really stuck it to some of the elders. She said, you don't turn 60 or 65 and you're automatically considered an elder. You have to earn respect. You have to do things that make you good for the community, basically. And what she said really connected with a lot of the people in the room. And when all of those kids came off the stage, they were all greeted by dozens of elders, dozens of youth that were just embracing her message, and really supporting them for what they said. She really had a powerful message to say, and she said it well.
I was told that there was some pushback against some of this. Were you able to verify any of that, that some people criticized her for speaking out?
Yeah, there were. Cynthia Erickson is the group leader of those students that went up there. And the night, I believe it was the night after, so that would have been the first day of the conference, they got some calls from back home from family members who were upset that they were speaking so frankly about these things. One of the things Cynthia said, and I'll paraphrase, it might have been a family member or a parent told one of the kids, you know, if you go up there again, they were invited to speak in front of AFN. If you go up there again, don't bother coming home. And she said, one of the kids responded, fine, we won't come home. You know, in those kinds of situations, I think I thought it was really impressive to hear these kids take take responsibility and take action in their own lives to say, this is what's happening and we're not going to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And for them to say, we're going to do this regardless of what the people back home think, was really something else.
Jacqueline, did you have a sense that this was somehow a turning point? I know that when I first started covering some of these issues in rural Alaska, I was told that it's taboo. You can't talk about these things. There's too much pain and shame and anger associated with it. How significant do you think this was at this AFN?
Well, I think it is a big deal that the kids came out and spoke from their hearts and put this out there. It wasn't even on the agenda at AFN, really. There was one resolution about suicide prevention, and when people, the kids brought up a lot of feelings. I mean, it's sort of turned the direction of the convention. And when they were talking about the one resolution that had to do with suicide prevention, some of the discussion that came up was, you know, we're asking for support from federal agencies to deal with this, but we can't wait for them. And something else that had come up at Elders and Youth was that there was a group from Kotzebue who came and spoke, kids from Kotzebue. And they talked about Kotzebue and the Northwest Arctic Borough, the school district, Manilook, the social services organization, and all these organizations and individuals up in Northwest Alaska. This part of the state had a huge, probably one of the highest rates of suicide in the state. And several years ago, everybody came together and said, this has got to stop. And they started programs with peer-to-peer leadership, with peer-to-peer counseling. They put more counselors in the villages. They had training for the teachers on signs of suicide and suicide intervention training. And they brought their suicide rate to zero. So that is incredibly heartening. But on the other hand, you have professionals who say that the population of Alaska Natives is just now getting back to what it was at the time of contact. From 2/3 to 3/4 of Alaska Natives died from murder, starvation, and disease in the first 200 years of contact. And they have this phrase they talk about multi-generational trauma, where people who have been through these those kinds of events become hyper-vigilant and anxious. They've done tests where they'll see a photo of a face and they'll see anger where other people don't. And it actually affects their hormonal system and that sort of thing. And they pass that on to their children. And so on the one hand, you have what's going on in Kotzebue is a good sign. On the other hand, you have this
generational
large
trauma.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the state of Alaska Alaska doesn't have enough detox beds. There aren't enough treatment programs.
Right.
The youth treatment program in Sitka was closed because of sequestration. So you have kind of, you know, we're not all moving in the same direction the way the Northwest.
Sort of a patchwork approach to a very large problem. Kyle, a lot of what the young people had to say during AFN had to do with alcohol and drug abuse. You're working on a series right now that looks at alcohol use and abuse in Alaska. The Daily News won a Pulitzer for its People in Peril series a couple of decades ago. One of the postings that you had on your blog about this series was about the number of suicides that have a relationship to alcohol, that it's much higher here than in the lower 48. What are you able to find about why that may be?
Well, I wrote that blog post partly because I wanted to pose a question, and I wanted to hear from people who, from Alaskans who wanted to talk about alcohol and suicide. And you know, in that blog post, I asked that question, you know, why is that? And I wasn't being rhetorical, I meant it. Why is that? I'm interested in writing about that topic. I haven't done kind of a proper print story as part of this specific series on that topic yet, and I was just kind of putting a call out to hear from people who, you know, have experienced suicide in their own families that are alcohol related, people maybe who have been drinking and survived a suicide attempt on their own. And that was a pretty thinly reported blog post in the sense that I was aware of the numbers. Like one thing I'm looking at as I write these stories, I'm looking for things that just surprised me personally. I grew up in Alaska. I was not the paper when People in Peril was published, but I'm very familiar with it and I'm familiar with these issues. And so I'm looking for things that, you know, that are surprising or just lingering questions and thirdly, ideas that people have. And when it comes to suicide, one thing I was surprised by in terms of the numbers, and I hadn't looked at specifically before, was just the rate. You know, we know that we have a very high rate, but I was a little surprised at the frequency with which people have been drinking before they killed themselves. And I think that's, you know, common sense. You would not be surprised to hear that, but I was a little surprised that the rate is so much higher than the national rate.
Yes.
I just wonder about that.
What's the reception been like in communities? I grew up in a village, and I know that people in the village that I grew up in were fond of talking about each other, but they didn't like somebody from outside coming into their village and poking around or talking about them. How has it been to visit places and work with folks?
You know, I think you have kind of every type of experience, you know, if you talk to enough people. I mean, it's always, I think there's always some trepidation. We kind of show up, you know, we are clearly visiting, you know, people don't recognize us, kids have come up, you know, how long are you here? Like, mm-hmm. many questions. One thing about reporting for the Alcohol series is that typically I'll be in a community and I might be working on three different stories, and one might be about a fiddle dance, and one might be about, you know, traditional foods, and then one might be about suicide. And so, you know, some of the conversations are very intense and some are, you know, just kind of just chatting and pretty low key. You know, because we're only talking about alcohol, there's certainly, you know, we're met with a little bit more, people are skeptical. They don't want their community be portrayed as a place where people only drink, or that drinking is, you know, this shameful problem that doesn't exist in other places. And you know, the solution to that, I think, is just to kind of talk to as many people as we can. And, you know, we find, as we have with suicide, we find that, you know, many people don't want to tell their stories, but many people do. A surprising number do and feel like they want people to hear about what they've experienced, and they want kind of the larger state to kind of know what's happening in their backyard.
And do you find that the attitudes are changing? We're talking about sort of a sea change at AFN. These are perennial issues that get discussed every year, but there seem to be a lot larger response and a lot more support around the issue at AFN this year. What are you finding in the villages in rural Alaska about the attitudes toward alcohol and the associated problems?
You know, I feel like I haven't been on the ground enough for this particular project in enough communities to kind of to get a you know, to identify trends. I mean, in individual cases, I think you see people who, like when we were in Shishmaref, what you saw was a community that had been dry for, you know, 30 years. And so you have all these 20-somethings. They grew up in a community that has always been dry. And, you know, maybe they went off to college and came back. There are a few kids like that. Or just are, you know, they travel a lot. They're in Anchorage a lot. They're in Nome a lot. And then they don't necessarily want to leave their community. They don't want to leave their village. But they also don't want to live this life that is different than, you know, life in Anchorage. They want to be able to go and buy a beer with their pizza and, you know, think, you know what, we need to catch up with the rest of the state. And then, you know, there are others who feel the community is just too small, that's, you know, it's a Pandora's box, and that, you know, as soon as you start allowing, you know, it has nothing to do with allowing, you know, a beer at the pizza place. It's more about like unlocking just unlimited shipments of alcohol to the community. And, but to answer your question, I think that, you know, you have this generation who has kind of grown up with this idea that alcohol is a problem in Alaska, and also have grown up under local option, and some of them are certainly interested in trying something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. We'll stay on the issue of tribes. But Jacqueline, Senator Murkowski introduced an amendment to the Violence Against Women Act that created a lot of controversy in Alaska because it essentially excluded tribes in Alaska from certain protections under VAWA. Now there is legislation, the Safe Villages and Families Act of 2013, that would repeal that amendment that's sponsored by Senators Begich and Murkowski. What's the latest with that? Where's that at?
Well, under the Violence Against Women Act's reauthorization, tribes would be able to, first they'd be eligible for grants that would help with law enforcement. They'd also be able to...
Directly from the federal government.
Mm-hmm, to tribes, and they would be able to issue protective orders against offenders. And those are the two parts of VAWA that tribes were really interested in having the ability to exercise. And so now this bill that Murkowski and Begich have introduced would allow Alaska tribes to exercise that. So the thing is that the bill has been introduced a couple of times before, and Congress has not acted on it, and there's no guarantee that it's going to act on it now. So even though it now has bipartisan support where it didn't before, it's just a guessing game whether it'll go anywhere.
So this rule that was put into VAWA continues to stand at this point, so tribes aren't able to access those funding mechanisms. Jennifer, Governor Parnell talked about being more receptive to tribal court authority during his address to the Alaska Federation of Natives delegates. What did he say in that regard?
He announced a plan that would allow the state and tribes to enter into a memorandum of agreement that would allow the tribes to prosecute and make judgments in domestic violence cases only if the non-tribal member agreed. So that's kind of the kicker there, is that only if the non-tribal member agrees to be tried in a tribal court does the tribal court have this jurisdiction. Otherwise, they have the right to take it to a state court. One woman, Natasha Singh from the Tanana Chiefs Conference, had some very interesting choice words to say when she addressed AFN during the public comment period, or during the comment period of AFN, and she essentially said, we already have the ability to enter into agreements with the state. We don't see this as an expansion of our tribal jurisdiction. And she had some very harsh criticism for the governor, saying that while he was coming to AFN and saying essentially he wanted to expand tribal jurisdiction in a certain way that the people at AFN should know, at the same time, the state is engaged in the Simmons v. Park lawsuit, which the ADN actually did a really great story about in August. It's a Stevens Village tribal member who had his parental rights taken away in a Minto court, and the state is basically saying, we don't argue with you that he doesn't deserve to have his parental rights, but he deserves due process in a state court. So at the same time, Parnell was announcing this so-called expansion of tribal court jurisdiction, there were some in the audience who did not see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm remembering this case correctly, that person in the Minto tribal court case is a tribal member, but he wasn't from the Minto tribe, is that correct?
Stevens Village, right.
Right, okay. There's always calls to strengthen subsistence rules for tribes during AFN and throughout the year. Senator Murkowski, in her address to AFN, called some of the regulations and rules that the Federal Subsistence Board is using ridiculous, especially as it related to the population of the communities that are facing perhaps losing their rural designation. Jacqueline, the tribes have called for amending ANILCA to better protect subsistence. Did you talk to tribal leaders about that during AFN and what they're looking for legislatively?
I didn't talk to anybody specifically about amending the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. I did talk with Lee Wallace, who's the president of the Organized Village of Saxman, which is one of the communities that has been designated as non-rural.
Right.
And they've been protesting that ever since. Saxman, the population criteria is if a community is less than 2,500 it should be designated as rural. Saxman is less than 2,500 people, but there's another criterion that says if you're part of another community, you won't get rural designation. And the Federal Subsistence Board decided that Saxman is more like part of Ketchikan. And they looked at things like economy, are they on the road system, how close are they, do their kids go to the high school there. So President Obama called for a review of the rural designation process, mm-hmm. and that's underway right now. There was a deadline for public comments, but because of the federal government shutdown, that's been extended, so people still have the opportunity to comment on that. And that comment period ends December 2nd. And then there will be public hearings, and it's a process that's probably going to take a couple of years.
Kyle, where will you be traveling next for reporting on this series on alcohol? Are you getting a sense of the why in these travels? I know you're just kind of getting underway with some of this, but where are you going next? And
well, we're kind of deciding that right now. There's kind of three places on the table, and one I need to figure that out soon. Mm-hmm. But I'm still doing a lot of reporting in Anchorage in the meantime. I mean, one thing that's different about this project is that, and one thing I try and tell people a lot is that it's, unlike People in Peril, it's about the whole state. So, I want to be in Fairbanks. I want to be in Juneau. I'm not just going to villages. I'm also writing about drinking in the cities, which is, as big or if not a bigger problem in many ways. So I'm anxious to kind of hit the population centers, the major population centers, each of which is kind of handling alcohol a little bit differently in interesting ways, as well as the villages. And so we're still figuring that out.
Mm-hmm. Are communities working to do more than respond? I know that there's a lot of efforts around responding to try to keep people safe. Here in Anchorage, they have the Community Service Patrol that rides out and picks up people that are a danger to themselves if they've had too much to drink. And you reported on a program in Nome. But are there efforts beyond just sort of this triage approach?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And it's something that I kind of plucked out of the Nome story because, I was trying to keep that story streamlined to one specific idea, which was that people had died there for many, many years. It was a place where, it's cold, people would get inebriated, and they would die outside. And now they're, what's kind of amazing about Nome is it's not just like the CSP. It's a pretty different project. I mean, they have people who are like CSP, but then they have this whole other project where it's just volunteers, people who work at the hospital or at the radio station, who are out all night long with flashlights, just kind of shining them in the nooks and crannies. They're not driving around. They're just literally walking around, kind of looking on the beach for people and finding them. And so that would be the triage. And then what's happening behind the scenes, kind of a step back, is there are a few things in the works at the shelter, for example, where there's no housing, there's no Carlick Manor in Nome. They would like to have something like that. They'd like to have a housing first place, like kind of wet housing. And they'd also like to have sober housing. They'd like to have both of those things. But until they get there, they're doing just kind of small things. Like there'll be a family that can't afford the high rent in Nome, or there'll be a person, a homeless person in Nome who is not going to stop drinking right away, but should not be living on the street as the winter comes. So the shelter will pay to put them in a hotel, and the hotel will give them a reduced rate. And it's just this very kind of grassroots, kind of behind the scenes thing that's happening. And further down the line, I think you'll see probably an effort to build like kind of a proper housing first facility there, just like there's in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. And that seems to be one way where it wants to go, where people, where advocates are very interested, is those kind of facilities.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, Jacqueline, sequestration and how that's impacted some treatment facilities, mm-hmm. Especially in Sitka. It closed down the treatment facility there. Jennifer, I was going to ask you this question as well. What was the conversation at AFN about the impacts of sequestration on tribes? If you have a quick answer, and then we'll get something from Jacqueline, too, in our last minute here.
Ed Thomas, he's the president of the Tlingit Haida Central Council, has actually been the go-to guy at AFN to talk about these things. He gave a very lengthy report during the NCAI AFN meeting that happened before the AFN convention started. And I got to talk with him after the convention was over. And right now, in the first round of sequestration, he said Tlingit Haida has been able to absorb some of the cuts. He says if it happens again, that he won't be able to, that they'll have to start making cuts to programs that are specifically focused on providing support, be it financial or counseling, otherwise, to families. And he doesn't want to see that happen. He said they're currently working on legislation that would exempt tribal entities from the next round of sequestration if that should happen.
I know that there was a discussion about exempting the Indian Health Service from cuts, just as the VA has been exempted. So there was a conversation about that. Jacqueline, I wanted to ask you a little more about that, but I think we're about out of time.
Oh, okay.
So we'll hold that for another Alaska edition. Thank you so much to my guests, Kyle Hopkins, Jacqueline Estes, and Jennifer Canfield. Michael Carey will be back with you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.